Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
And welcome to The Exchange, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan. In for Kelly, here's what's ahead. A slightly hotter inflation print may be pushing Fed rate cuts even further down the line. Markets now pricing in just a 50-50 chance in June, but Wall Street largely shrugging it off. The S&P and NASDAQ set to snap a two-day losing streak and a big bond auction about to happen. Boeing down again after the New York Times reports it failed 33 out of 89 FAA product audits. On top of that, its February deliveries trailed Airbus. What is next for Boeing? What is next for Boeing's investors? Plus, today, equal pay day. The date in a new year, a woman has to work to earn what a man did the previous year. We'll speak with the CEO of a company working to make compensation more transparent and get the payroll name that one analyst says is undervalued. All that in the next 59 and a half minutes. Well, we begin with today's market action. Dom Chu is here with that. Dom.
I'm going to give you the shake it off numbers, as you point out, Brian, because right now we're talking decent sized gains across the board for the major indices. It's green across the screen, led by what's happening with the tech heavier NASDAQ composite, up about 1 full percent, 150 points for the composite index. 16,168 the last trade there. Meanwhile, you got kind of the S&P 500 benefiting from that big tech trade, up 2/3 of 1%, 34 handles, 5,152 for the S&P 500. And the Dow Industrial is the laggard of the session so far. The blue chip index only up 1/4 of 1%, 38,883. That's worth about 113 points. No records yet, but we're close, so we'll keep an eye on that. The other thing to watch out for is what's happening with big technology in that trade, because as Brian pointed out, we did get a slightly, by some measures, hotter than expected inflation print with the CPI today. Well, we're shrugging it off because interest rates are pretty much higher across the board, bonds on the government side on the offer. But NVIDIA is up 4.5%, Meta Platforms up 2.5%, Amazon up 2%, Microsoft up 2%. So there seems to be at least a feeling that things were less bad, or the inflation story isn't enough to really, really derail that large cap tech trade. But the notable laggard, as has been for a while now, is Apple, still down about 0.1%. But one stock on the tech side that is making a record high today is Oracle on the mega cap side of things. We'll put a star right up here, up 12%, better than expected earnings, slight miss in revenues, but everybody's very excited about the growth they're seeing with regard to Oracle's cloud business, especially that OCI, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. A lot of that commentary coming out about Oracle and its growth prospects there, up 12%, a big move higher, driving that tech trade, Bri. I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dominic Chu. Dom, thank you very much. All right, so let us begin with this morning's CPI number. Steve Leishman is here diving in with all the details on the inflation print.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, thanks. About the best you can say is that the inflation data is not getting much worse, but it's not getting a whole lot better. And the February CPI stalled at rates that showed little progress in the Fed's battle against inflation. Here are the numbers. Month on month, 0.4, in line with expectations, but up from 0.3 in January. Headline year over year, 3.2, up a tick from 3.1. The core 0.4, a tenth, not quite a tenth, but a part of a tenth hotter, rounding up to 0.4. But it did fall year over year because of hotter numbers in the past dropping out. Where was and where wasn't inflation? Well, food was flatline at zero. That's good news for Americans out there. But energy up higher, 2.3%, with higher gas prices. New vehicles down a tick. Used cars reversing their trend, up 0.5. Up 0.5. And owner's equivalent rent, that's the important one, 0.4%, down from 0.6. We've been waiting for that real estate measure to decline. It did, at least finally here. Before CPI, May was at 21%, now running about a 15% probability of a rate cut. June at 70, not much real change there. Kind of interesting that markets still see the Fed beginning those rate cuts in June, with the question being at next week's meeting, do Fed officials still project three cuts this year. The February inflation data may still have some effects of those one-time beginning of the year price hikes that we saw, and so could cool off if that's the case. But it's not going to make the Fed today, at least, any more confident in cutting rates and getting inflation back down to 2%. Meanwhile, the CNBC NRF retail monitor, powered by real credit card data we get from Affinity Solutions, shows a rebound in consumer spending in February, helped a bit by the leap year, though. Retail sales ex auto and gas up 1.1% compared to the 0.2 decline in January, year over year up 6.3%. Takeout, go to our core retail measure, which also removes restaurants, and that was up 1%. Takeout at the year over year up 6.7%, versus 3.2% in January. The data was helped by the leap day, but you still had gains when that day was removed. The consumer strength may be playing a role in the stubborn inflation numbers, Brian, meaning that lower inflation may ultimately require a slower economy.
Wow. And we talked about the Fed expectations there, Steve, because the data matters, but the data matters more so in how it may impact the Fed. Could you just dive in? I know it's kind of a point of contention to the real role of housing. I know you've touched on it. There's a big debate about just some people will argue that almost all of it is housing related. What's the real take?
Well, I think housing is definitely a part of it, and that the data is not necessarily picking up what we believe to be the declining rents out there in the economy, and this data that the government collects tends to lag it. At the same time, there is this concern that once the Fed begins to lower rates, you could have a reacceleration in housing costs and housing prices. What we need, Brian, and what the Fed can't do, as far as I know, the Fed and Jay Powell do not have hard hats and cranes and a construction company to build houses. There is a housing shortage in this country. So we may be stuck with persistently high housing inflation. And that may be something that is outside of the realm of monetary policy, unless what you hope is that if they do lower rates, it spurs construction and trying to solve this supply-demand issue we have. But again, it's unclear if the Fed really wants to be motivated by that. But I do think there is some scope for those hard hats and cranes, Brian, for the Fed to solve the housing problem.
The state bird of Nashville, the crane. Steve Leisman, thank you very much. It's not a state, but you got my point. Sure. Steve, appreciate it. All right. Well, no matter what the Fed does at the next meeting, which is next week, one of your next guests says, quote, "The alchemy of low rates is over." And while broad spending remains strong, if you dig a little deeper, there are plenty of signs of potential weakness or slowdowns. How should you be positioning now based on all the available data? Joining us now on set, Jeff Klingelhofer. He is head of investments at Thornburg Investment Management, and Maddie Dester, head of global asset class services at Capital Group. Thanks to both of you here. Jeff, first to you. Does what Steve just told you about that CPI change your expectations for your clients about what the Fed does with rates?
No, I think if anything, it actually strengthens our expectations, right? What we've seen coming into this is an surprisingly resilient consumer in the face of higher inflation. And much like you said, the alchemy of low interest rates is over.
That well, you said that. I just quoted
I
you
said
back.
It.
I quoted you back to you. You can't quote you back to me back to you.
That consumer is struggling. And I think especially when you peel back the onion, yes, they're holding in enough to spend. But in order to keep that spending going, they're having to borrow. That low-end consumer is, we're seeing borrowing increase. We're seeing defaults increase. They're much weaker when you dig below the surface. And as we project forward, what that leaves us hesitant is the Fed continues to have an inflation problem. Super core services is still more than double what it was coming pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And that means the Fed isn't going to be likely to actually lower interest rates, and that consumer will struggle. The economy does have to slow in order for us to see inflation come down and a renormalization.
Not just credit cards. Buy now, pay later is also being used to buy things
and
like
housing.
Groceries. Okay, Maddie, to that point, we forget. It's easy to forget because all we've talked about is inflation since COVID. But the Fed has a dual mandate to maximize employment as well. We're starting to see a slowdown, a little bit of a slowdown in the job market. Layoffs tick up just a little bit, not a lot. What are you watching most closely?
Well, we're certainly watching both the inflation and the employment picture. One of the things that we notice about this cycle is the strength of the consumer right now, actually. So it's a little bit different than what we just heard. We look at the consumer balance sheet as quite strong. And so as inflation tends to moderate over time, our expectation is that yield curve will start to tip up, which is why we have added duration to our portfolios, again, driven by normalization by the Fed in the short end of the yield curve, as well as some of the supply-demand dynamics that we expect to see in the strong end or in the long end of the yield curve. So our expectation is that the consumer is actually quite strong here.
All right, Maddie and Jeff, stick around. We're not done with you, but we want to go now to Chicago. Rick Santelli, 10-year notes up for auction. The professor tracking and grading the auction at the SIBO.
You know, Sully, this is an important auction. It's a reopening. 39 billion tens. The original auction for the first primary issuance was 1 month ago. That's important. So what did the yield come out at on 39 billion reopened 10 years? 9 year, 11 month technically, 4.166. The problem was that it's 0.75 a basis point higher than the when issued market. Higher yield, lower price, the government selling. That was the biggest markdown on this for a C minus. Could have been a D plus if it was a primary auction. There's usually a less aggressive bidding process for the reopenings, and there are always two. Next month, we'll get another one. The metrics were all basically in line with 10 auction average. We did see that the dealers took down a little over 17%, 15% the 10 auction average. I find it very interesting that we see yields continuing to climb here. Remember, the short end is going to give you a glimpse of what CPI means to the Fed potentially, and the rest of the curve in the long end is really starting to focus more on debt, deficits, and issuance. This wasn't a particularly good auction, but I will draw your attention to the fact that with today's inflation data and Thursday PPI and retail sales, investors might have been taking the slow and easy route, Sully. Back to you.
Quickly, Rick, 17% going to dealers. It's not huge above the average, to your point, 2 percentage points. But whenever I see the percentage going to dealers, you know, it raises an eyebrow.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's just like the Country Inn buffet. Okay, if the food's really good, there's not much left on the buffet. In this instance, there's a few leftovers on the table.
Rick, thank you very much. Well said. Thank you. Jeff, you're on the fixed income side. What's your reaction to the auction? Are you starting to worry a little bit, or things still there appears to still be a good appetite for American debt, even with $34 trillion in debt?
And even at higher interest rates. But I think what this really brings up is you talked about the Fed dual mandate. They actually have three mandates, and that third one is actually moderate long-term interest rates, which I think really plays into the story here. So if I were to grade, right, as we think about three balance sheets, the consumer balance sheet, the corporate balance sheets, and the government balance sheet today is a D, and it's continuing to get worse in the face of higher debt payments. When you flip to the corporate balance sheet, it too, right, companies have net interest margins that expanded as they termed out short-term debt, and they're actually making more on the money market side, but they're deteriorating. And when we come to the consumer, again, it's all of these things as you peel back. It is challenging. Yeah. And I think what we see is in the face of higher interest rates, the economy does have to slow over time. So it has me still concerned.
Well, Maddie, listen, I'm a data guy. And I look at the data, I look at the markets, and I see the S&P up very nicely over the last couple of years. Debt has gone up. Deficits have gone up. Rates have gone up. And yet stocks, all they've done for the most part is go up. Should we be surprised by that? Because the market is saying it really doesn't seem to care.
Well, you know, from our perspective, debt is sustainable as long as borrowing rates stay significantly below the nominal growth rate. And so far, that is going to be the case from our perspective in the long term, even though in the face of debt to GDP ratios in the U.S. going to up to 180%. We still believe that there is a sustainability to that. The other point that we should keep in mind as investors is the amount of fiscal stimulus that will be working through the corporate environment, about $1.4 trillion in areas like artificial intelligence, in semiconductor creation, in electric vehicle transmission and infrastructure. These are significant supporters of economic growth. So despite the fact that we are, yes, seeing government debt increase, there's a reason for that, and the corporate environment and the overall economy will benefit from it.
Back to you quickly, Maddie. Is that where Capital Group then is recommending or putting its own money, its clients' money, in the sectors you just talked about?
Some of those areas, certainly. An area that we're seeing quite a lot of innovation and excitement around is healthcare. if we think about all the developments we've seen in gene therapy, in immunizations, the ability to manage risks of obesity. These are all things that are important for us as an organization, as selectors of securities. And keep in mind that there are strong global companies trading at significant discounts internationally to their U.S. peers. So we actually like the international area in those markets as well. So we don't think investors should overlook international developed markets, emerging markets.
Many of which have outperformed even the magnificent seven-led American S&P 500. More on the fixed income side, Jeff, where are you guys finding the best opportunities right now?
Yeah, for us, it's always about a balance of preservation of capital and safety, right? The core pillars of what fixed income is meant to be. But on the same token, much like Maddie, we're also adding duration to portfolios as ballast, because when and if, where we believe we're heading into that probably gently hard landing, eventually we'll get there.
Gently hard landing.
Gently hard landing.
That's like it's jumbo shrimp. It sounds like landing, an oxymoron, right?
I'm trying to keep that optimistic view, but in the face of higher debt and higher interest payments, we are heading there. We know we're heading there. It's just a question of when. We want to make sure that in our investors' portfolios perform, have that countercyclical nature, and really adding duration is the way to do that today.
You just wonder if debt and deficits will ever matter. They haven't yet. We'll see. Jeff, Maddie, great discussion. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, we are just getting started here on The Exchange, and on deck, Boeing's blues dragging down the airlines one in a big way. The CEO of its commercial airplanes sending a note to employees moments ago. We'll bring it to you and look at the details, what it also might mean for your spring and summer travel. Plus, Bitcoin, just a little off its highs, hovering just below 70K. Is this the moment Coinbase investors have been waiting for? You're going to hear from one analyst on that next.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
All right, welcome back. Boeing shares, they are getting hit hard again. Likely on a New York Times report that the FAA found dozens of production issues with the 737 MAX line. Stock is now down 30% to start the year, on pace for its worst quarter since the beginning of the pandemic. And remember, coming into this year, Boeing was on no fewer than 6 top picks of Wall Street firms' lists. Wow, a lot of airlines also coming down big today. Phil LeBeau is here with more on where we stand with Boeing right now.
And Brian, you made a reference to the internal memo that was just sent out by Stan Deal, who is the head of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, sending it to the staff out in Renton, Washington. We're not going to go into all the details because some of it's fairly wonky. But one thing that they do reference in here, Stan Deal says that they will do an additional internal audit of their processes. And that's because the FAA audit, and we, by the way, have confirmed these numbers. These are what the FAA auditors found over a 6-week check of the production systems. 89 checks were done. 33 times they found failures in how the process was followed or not followed by the workers there in Renton, Washington. And there were 97 instances of noncompliance. Boeing says in response to this and the report that has come out regarding all of these failures, based on the FAA audit, our quality stand downs, and the recent expert panel report, we continue to implement immediate changes and develop a comprehensive action plan to strengthen safety and quality and build the confidence of our customers and their passengers. As you take a look at shares of Boeing, Keep in mind, there are three investigations going on right now. You've got the DOJ. You've got the FAA. It has not finished its investigation right now, as well as the NTSB, which is still putting together its final report in terms of the Alaska Airlines door plug blowout. Max production capped at 38 per month. Also, take a look at Spirit AeroSystems. They were also audited by the FAA. The New York Times noted that they had 7 failures out of 13 production checks. And remember, we've talked about this for some time, Brian. Boeing is considering buying Spirit, bringing that production in-house in hopes that it can correct the problems that begin at Spirit and often lead to issues down the road when it comes to final production in Renton, Washington.
We've already seen a little bit of it, and I know there's the deal possibility as well, but it feels like, Phil, we're going to get more to a point where the finger pointing between the two is only going to accelerate.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We might already be there, Brian, in terms of the finger pointing between the two. Look, there's nobody sitting here saying, oh, it's not me, it's your fault. I think there is a joint recognition of the issues that are happening both at Spirit as well as in Renton. And when we've talked with Dave Calhoun, he has not shied from saying, you know what? It is what it is, and we have to fix it. And we haven't had a chance to talk with Pat Shanahan, who is the CEO at Spirit AeroSystems in Wichita, Kansas. But my guess is if you sat him down, he would be equally candid in saying we have let our customers down, and their primary customer is Boeing.
Yeah, now this problem is starting to apparently, I mean, at least based on the markets talking, hit some of the airlines' bottom lines, or at least the market thinks it could.
Well, look, the market is selling off, and let's take a look at Southwest and its new plan in terms of max deliveries. This should not have come as a surprise to anybody because they talked, and we've talked to Bob Jordan in the past, that they were likely going to have to adjust the number of maxes that they were going to take this year. Remember, it's an all 737 fleet that they have. 46 deliveries this year is the new guidance. That's down from what was originally expected of 79 deliveries this year. They do not expect to get any MAX 7s in 2024. The plane hasn't even been certified right now. So you're looking at a 25 or 26 beginning for those MAX 7 deliveries. When you take a look at shares of Southwest, keep in mind that they're also reassessing their full year guidance. Now, that may be the additional pressure on the downside here. They've got to cut their capacity. That's the bottom line, Brian. You've got an all 737 fleet. You factored in how many you thought you were going to receive. That's not going to be happening. We're also getting other guidance from other airlines today. American saying that its Q1 loss will likely be near the lower end of its guidance. Mm-hmm. And then we heard from Ed Bastian at Delta this morning. He expects their Q1 earnings to be near the high end of the guidance for the first quarter, which they expect to earn between 25 and 50 cents a share.
And Delta, I'm almost exclusively on United because I live in New Jersey, Phil. Probably you too in Chicago, but I know you fly Delta more than I do. They've got a lot of Airbuses though, right? I mean, Delta's fleet, I think, is a little more diversified.
Boeing. They have Boeing and Airbus.
I mean, they've got both.
But they don't have Maxes. Yeah, they don't have Maxes. I think they get the first Maxes, which will be the Max 10s. That's an order that they have. But they've even said 27 is when they think they're going to get them. But when we asked Ed Bastian about that this morning, he said, yeah, that's my guess at this point. That may change over time. And it's not a huge part of what the fleet is going to be in the future. It will be significant. But at this point, it's so far down the road that any delay is not impacting Delta at this point.
Okay. Phil LeBeau, it's a big story. Phil, thank you very much. Do appreciate that. All right.
You bet.
Coming up, will it be a hammer for ARM? What the end of the semiconductor firm's lockup might mean, DeBosa is up with that next. Plus, speaking of insider selling, CNBC.com is tracking the big-name corporate execs who are dumping their stock, and there are some big names on that list. You can see it. Go to CNBC.com/pro for the full story.
People today can spend half their lives over 50, so it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
Good day, everyone. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update. The United States is preparing a military aid package for Ukraine. That is according to Reuters. The package could be valued at up to $400 million, with an announcement expected later today. It is the first movement in months since additional funding was blocked in Congress, and it comes as the Financial Times reports the European Union is also close to reaching a deal for more than $5 billion in military aid. Lawyers for former Jeffrey Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell are set to argue today in front of a federal appeals court that she should be released from prison. Her lawyers are arguing that Maxwell was protected by a non-prosecution agreement between Epstein and prosecutors. And after weeks of testing, the IRS has finally launched its e-filing system for taxpayers in a dozen states. A direct file is a free online tool. People who have very simple W-2 forms and claim a standard deduction may be eligible to use it this year. Brian, back to you.
All right, Tyler Matheson, thank you. All right, on deck. Today is Equal Pay Day. That is the date that symbolizes how far into the year women must work to earn what their male peers earned earlier in the previous year. On average, women in the U.S. earned about 20% less than men, or 83.6 cents on the dollar last year. And the gap is even larger for women of color. Up next, we'll take a closer look at the salary shortfall and what companies can do to help close that gap. Welcome back to The Exchange. Today is Equal Pay Day. That means a woman would have to work until today to earn what her male counterpart did last year. And according to new data from CNBC and SurveyMonkey, compensation is not improving. Julia Boorstin joining us now with the findings. Julia.
Hi, Brian. Well, our annual CNBC SurveyMonkey Women at Work report finds a female workforce that is frustrated with fewer raises and less career advancement. The survey of a sample of nearly 10,000 women found that 39% of women secured pay raises this year, but that's down from 44% who got raises the prior year. And 17% of women say their salary is actually lower than it was a year ago. That's more than the 15% of respondents who reported pay declines last year. Now, we are also seeing women frustrated with their lack of progress. 18% of women said their career experienced a setback. That's nearly as many who said their career has advanced. And many women are looking for a change. 9% of women say they quit their jobs last year, and 22% say they are thinking about quitting. Now, a key reason why is work-life balance, which 1 in 5 women say has worsened in the past year. Among half of those women saying it's due to increased workload. Parents and women of color are increasingly concerned about career penalties that might come from pursuing flexible work. Now, it's worth noting that desire for flexibility is not due to any lack of ambition. 88% of women say they're either very or somewhat ambitious. And Brian, you can find more from the results of our survey on CNBC.com.
All right, Julia, thank you. And by the way, Julia will be hosting the inaugural CNBC Changemakers Summit, Women Transforming Business, on April 18th. You want to go? Well, you can sign up for it at cnbcevents.com or by scanning the QR code on your screen. All right, can salary transparency help close the gender pay gap? Your next guest is an executive recruiter turned startup founder who is looking to pull back on the curtain of compensation. Joining us now is Nolan Church, CEO of Faircomp. Nolan, thanks for coming on the program. If I was going to push back at all, I'm not pushing back on the idea of equal compensation, but I would make sure that the job title, the job requirements, and the job experience were equal when we're comparing these things. Is that a fair thing to say?
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me on. That's entirely fair to say, but I don't think it's that hard to do. Especially with software and technology that we have today, figuring out your level and how you compare to your peers shouldn't be challenging. The problem is that employers don't want to share that data with their employees.
Yeah, and I think that's listen, we'd all love to know what our colleagues are making, right, Nolan? I think that's kind of what you're helping them do, but you're not, your data is not like this guy over here makes this. Are you, you're sort of compiling it, I'm guessing, in sort of a more broad framework so people know, I'm at this company, I've done the same job for the same amount of time as that person, and they're making 15% more than I am.
Well, let me tell you how it works. So there's industry data. So this is, say you're a software engineer. How do you compare against your software engineering peers within your industry? So say you're at tech, you have 7 years of experience. generally, this is roughly the band that you can expect. But if you work in a larger company to where we can anonymize your data and ensure that we have privacy, that your peers can't see you from anyone else, then we also want to be able to show you how you stack rank versus your peers with the same level and the same level of experience.
And these are industries where I'm assuming that performance, if, for example, sales, obviously if you're in sales and you sell twice as much as somebody else, the person who's not selling a lot should not expect the same compensation. These have got to be industries with, I'm guessing, just more direct salaries, probably with some bonus, et cetera.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, sales, it's pretty obvious why a peer would be making more as it relates to cash compensation. Now, equity compensation can be something entirely different. And that's something we want to provide as well. But I think engineering or design or product are fair areas to look at, which is, this is what my level is. This is what how many years of experience I have. And then over time, we will add in vectors such as performance, again, in a way that you can anonymize mm-hmm. where you can't compare exactly who the peer is. But the idea is you should be able to tell what your company pays for your job. And you should also be able to tell what the industry pays. We had all these pay transparency laws 2 years ago, and candidly, like, they have no teeth. Companies are posting ranges that have somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000 on the base salary. I don't think these pay transparency laws have accomplished much, and that's why we need software to help solve the problem.
What would you do if you could change those laws, if you could add something to them?
Yeah, look, I don't know if laws is the right way to accomplish this mission. And I think we're going to see these laws ultimately be played out in court to see how much teeth they actually have, which I candidly think is not a whole lot. I think that this ultimately requires software in addition to people talking to each other. So employers pay for compensation data. That's how they come up with offers. That data is shared amongst all of their industry peers, including their competitors. The way we think about this problem at FairComp is to invert that. So employees can share their data with their industry peers and their colleagues in an anonymized way so they can have access to data coming to the table to help them better negotiate.
Well said. Nolan Church, CEO of FairComp. Nolan, we appreciate you coming on CNBC. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, sticking with worker pay in a different way. Mizuho raising its price target on payroll processing company ADP, seeing some positive signs in the payroll company's growth trajectory. It also says the stock is undervalued, trading at a forward P.E. ratio of 25, while some of its peers trade a higher multiple, some maybe even around 40. Let's talk about that and more with Dan Dolev. He is fintech equity research analyst at Mizuho. Dan, good to see you on again.
Always
ADP is one of the biggest companies based in New Jersey. Former Senator Frank Lautenberg founded it. I think at one point he was the richest man in New Jersey. But it's like, I think it's a misunderstood company. They do a lot more than just write checks, correct?
Yes, and we totally agree with that. It's a $100 billion company. It's a huge company.
Is that big?
It's huge.
Okay.
Yeah, I was shocked too when
I saw Roseland, this. You go Roseland, New Jersey, right off 280. There you go.
Yeah, you won't think you see that in New Jersey, right? I thought the best thing was CNBC in New Jersey, and then, you know.
Well, we are. They're a close second.
They're a close second.
But why are they undervalued?
Yeah, look, they're undervalued because, like, 5 years ago, there was an activist that went after them, and they fixed the business since then, and they've improved organic growth, right? So they fixed the small part of the business, so when they're going after SMBs, and now they fixed the high end, and they're regaining the share that they've been losing to those, like,
paychecks.
Even more than that, like the Paylocities, Workdays, et cetera. There's these, like, cloud-based disruptors. Now they're basically regaining the share, and you see that in the number. They're closing the organic growth gap versus the
peers. How are they doing that? Because these newer cloud-based companies like Workday, I mean, I would imagine they're newer, they're more nimble, maybe they're hungrier.
They are hungry, but ADP basically took its time, fixed the cloud business. Now they're going with the new solution. And I'm seeing that all over tech, where the incumbent initially loses share, fixes the business, comes back winning. And it's exactly the same pattern we're seeing with ADP.
Okay, switching gears to coin.
Yes.
You might have heard Bitcoin's been in the news a little bit lately. I don't know if you've been following
it.
It's
the first
running.
Time I hear about this.
Not at 70 now, but I mean, Coinbase, they've had some issues. They've had some, yes. Tech issues in the last couple of days. What's the view on Coinbase and how they fall into the crypto ecosystem now that ETFs are out?
Correct. So Coinbase has been highly correlated with Bitcoin. I mean, my view on Bitcoin doesn't change.
Almost one-to-one, right?
Yes, but history tells us an interesting lesson here. If you go back to 2018, Square, now called Block, which I like a lot, used to be perfectly correlated. And guess what? That correlation fades. So anyone that's bullish on Coinbase saying, oh, Bitcoin's going to the moon, Coinbase will go to the moon, those days are numbered. Eventually, that correlation will break. But fundamentally, the reason we don't like Coinbase, and this is important, high volumes bring in sort of the whales, like your tie.
Like you got elephants on your elephants tie versus and I have whales on my tie. We didn't even coordinate that.
So they bring in the whales, and those whales don't pay as much of a fee. So you're going to get take rate compression, plus they only custody like 40% of the ETFs. So all this good thing that's happening with crypto, they're not benefiting fully from it, and that's why our call on coins is an underperformer.
So you're suggesting, or you're not suggesting, you're saying that there will be a day that Bitcoin goes up and Coinbase does not?
It happened in the past, it'll happen again.
Okay, because you know we don't hear, is there a name that's in the crypto space that you do like at Mizuho?
I love Robinhood, and the reason for that is because—
as a crypto play.
To an extent, okay. Right? So it's only like, what, 10-15%
of revenue. Crypto-adjacent.
Crypto-adjacent. It doesn't really correlate with Bitcoin. I mean, Robinhood stock's been doing well, but it's not doing as well as Coinbase because there's a lot more to it, right? They're expanding into Europe. They're getting into more deeper into equities, IRAs. They're winning share from Charles Schwab. You know, I met with Vlad last week, and they're so bullish on, like, the European expansion. Who knows? Maybe they'll get into Asia. I think the real way to play it is to be— to have a balanced kind of portfolio of assets.
So the Robinhood play ultimately is international.
International and more balanced because they have equities, they could trade the you could trade the ETFs, you could do IRA. It's not just a monolithic kind of play on like Bitcoin minus, you know, trading fee reduction over time.
Likes Hood, dislikes Coin, likes ADP. We like you. I like your tie. Dan Dolev, thank you.
Like your tie.
We should swap out the world's largest land mammal, world's largest mammal. Dan, thank you. I'm not talking about myself, hopefully. All right, coming up, shares of ARM Holdings more than doubling since the IPO. And after today, a six-month lockup. The lockup period is ending, enabling insiders to sell. Is that a bullish or bearish sign for ARM and semis? We'll talk about it with Deirdre Bosa coming up. Welcome back. The lockup period for chip manufacturer ARM Holdings expiring today. That is the six-month period after an IPO during which insiders are restricted from selling their holdings to prevent more volatility, he said. Deirdre Bosa joining us now for today's Tech Check. RID, what should we be watching as the lockup expires?
Well, some of the action has already happened. ARM is down 15% in the month just leading up to this expiration because it gives insiders a chance to sell. Now, I talked earlier about the Masasan of it all. SoftBank has the biggest stake, still 90%. So they are the biggest wild card. But let's talk about the other investors and why they could potentially have reason to sell. For them, it could be a question of rotation. Do you lock in ARM's outsized gains? Remember, this is a stock that has more than doubled since it went public last September. Do you take those gains and do you put them into other semis, right? These are the picks and shovels of the AI era. So do you look elsewhere? ARM's forward price to earnings ratio, consider this, it is more than triple that of NVIDIA's. That is a massive premium. And Brian, as you well know, investors can't get enough of NVIDIA. There is this ETF that gives investors two times the daily return of NVIDIA, and it has just gone parabolic. Ticker NVDL, it has grown to $1.4 billion since launching at the end of 2022, and it's nearly tripled this year. It's up another nearly 10% today. It's a lot of risk to take on, but a lot of upside as well if NVIDIA is going one way, which, as we know, it has been for some time now. But ARM's insiders, right, these are some of the biggest stakeholders that couldn't sell until today. They may be more strategic, and thus they may have more reason to hold on for the longer run. According to FactSet, those top three insiders are Mubadala, Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, Alphabet, and NVIDIA itself. And what we've learned over the past few months, Brian, at least what ARM is presenting, is that NVIDIA and ARM go hand in hand. You need ARM CPUs to help build, to complement NVIDIA GPUs in data centers.
One might say they're connected at the hip or the elbow, as it
or
may be.
Arm?
I'll stop making the dad puns. Go back to the first point you make, Masayoshi Son of SoftBank. They own what? Yeah. You said like 90% of it.
90%.
So they are, if they decide to dump a ton of it because they made a ton of money, that could be a negative event. So it really sounds like it's going to come down to what the folks at SoftBank ultimately do.
Yes. So if they were to dump a bunch at once, it would be a negative event, right? Supply and demand, there'd be a lot more shares out there for investors to buy. So it's likely not going to do that. However, if we look at what Masa-san has done with his previous golden jewel of the Japanese conglomerate, that would be Alibaba, there could be reason to believe that over time he may draw down on that ARM stake. Alibaba, he held billions, tens of hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Alibaba. He drew on that for SoftBank buybacks as collateral to help fund the Vision Fund 2. And he has said that he wants to go on the offensive with AI. So that ARM stake is worth a heck of a lot more than it did at IPO, than it did over the last 10 years, over the time that SoftBank has held it. So it is certainly plausible that he could draw on at least some of that.
And remember, when will we know? Is it tonight or tomorrow? Like, what's the timeline here, Dee?
Today, I believe the lockout, the shares come up, so they can actually be traded today.
Okay.
And the run-up, I mean, again, I don't think if you have a large stakeholder, they're not going to sell a huge hunk.
They should fire their trader. Because
yeah, exactly.
That's T-R-A-D-E-R, not T-R-A-I-T-O-R.
Maybe the next quarter. I mean, they're often asked about this in the quarterly report. So maybe there's some tea leaves to be read then.
Yeah, if you're going to dump a ton of stock, just do it slowly over a number of days to not move the stock or tip people off to what you're doing. Deirdre Bosa, good stuff. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, coming up. Municipal bond funds posting their third straight week of inflows last week. That's right, muni bond funds. We'll tell you where the buying opportunities may be in muni bond funds. Stick around.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Rick Santelli here live on the SIBO floor with a special guest, Matt Fabian from Municipal Market Analytics. You heard Sully. There's some opportunity potentially in the muni space, and Matt's the guy to talk to. Matt, welcome.
Hey, Rick. Thanks.
Listen, there's a tale of two muni markets right now, and it's all about banks and the types of institutions that used to be big players in certain parts of the muni curve that don't seem to be playing anymore, and that may afford some opportunities. Tell us about that.
No, that's totally right. So, you know, the individuals, right, the demand for muni bonds has been dominated through the fourth quarter, through the first part of this year by individuals, households, buying into either directly through family offices or separately managed accounts. They're buying bonds just like they used to. Things are scarce. They know, right, they can get 3%, 3.5%. That's a taxable equivalent of like 6, 7% with minimal default risk. The rest of the market, the banks, you know, banks have backed away. Banks, you know, got hurt, right? When the Fed started to raise
rising interest rates.
Rising interest rates.
So
insurance companies don't have the money.
With the banks backing out of that space, what should investors be looking at? And normally banks look at a lesser quality. What about the quality we're looking at with respect to whether it's investment grade or not?
No, for sure. So, you know, typically individuals want, you know, 10-year bonds or so. Think about going out just a little bit further. And instead of going for your AA or AAA rated bonds, think about getting, you know, maybe a little bit lower on the credit curve as well. So long as you're staying within sort of traditionally safe sectors, high grade sectors, your default risk is going to be really low.
You know, I like that. Traditionally safe sectors. So we're mostly like you talking about what? GOs, utility revenue bonds. What types of areas are you looking at very specifically, and quantify how many defaults we've had in some of those spaces that you like?
I mean, we've had very few. So heading into the pandemic, right, we expected that there would be lots more trouble, right? All the headlines, all the news, you know, work from home, commercial real estate, all these things, but it hasn't happened. You know, we had in the past 4 years, since 2021, there have been 5 or 6 muni bond defaults in these sort of sectors, geo bonds, safe sector utilities, things like that. That's out of a universe of about 25,000. So 5 or 6 out of 25,000 defaulted, that's not many.
No, and it sounds like opportunities. Now, what type of returns are we talking about? And this is the last question. How does potentially the Fed timeline of interest rate cuts affect that? Your final thoughts, Matt.
Well, this is the thing. Once the Fed starts to cut rates, I'm assuming more of the institutional money will come back in. And so that could, you know, so that could really tighten up the market and remove the opportunity that's there right now ahead of it. And again, you're looking at maybe 3 or 3.5% tax-free, which is like 6.5% after, you know, a taxable equivalent, a corporate bond that you would have to buy would have to give you 6-7% with minimal default risk.
Real quickly, Matt, I'm going to stretch this out. We're going to get one more question. Are there any states or areas of the country that you would prefer and any that you might want to avoid? Final thought.
Sure. I like Texas. I like Ohio. I like New York. Even California has some opportunities. Avoiding Missouri, Alabama, and absolutely the Virgin Islands.
Excellent. Matt Fabian, it's always interesting to talk to you. Managing Director of MMA, please join me again in the future. Sully, back to you.
Thanks, Rick.
All right, Rick and Matt, thank you very much. By the way, before we go here on the exchange, check out shares of Illumina. Reuters reporting that Carl Icahn has dropped his threat to challenge their board of directors. Shares right now down about 4% on the news. CNBC reached out to Illumina. They have declined to comment. That does it for us. I'll see you tomorrow here.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.